We want to thank our worship team for that fine and inspirational matins. Let's thank our worship team together, shall we? Some of you will remember the name of Dr. John Schiller. He was the director of LENS before I assumed that responsibility a year ago. And I called up John and I said, you helped plan this conference, so come on board. And he said that he couldn't be with us. He's doing a little doctoring, but he asked that we give you his greetings. And so hello to each one of you from Dr. John Schiller. And he's thinking about us this week. Some of you have asked me about tapes. Will they be available? And yes, Holden is taping all of our sessions, worship, each piece of this experience that we have together. And you may select tapes that you would like to have. And forms are available at the Multimedia Center in Koinonia. They're out in front. Or they're at the bookstore, and you can fill out what tapes you want. They're $5 a tape. These are about an hour session. And they will have them available for you before you go home, except perhaps the last lectures, depending upon the demand. And if those are not immediately available, they will send you that last lecture. So you can sign up for those, not with LENS, but with Holden. At the bookstore or at the Multimedia Center, $5 a tape, and I think you should also include your address on the piece that you fill out. Just to also tell you that oftentimes both lay and clergy ask me, are continuing education credits available? And they are for this conference. And there are going to be forms over there with Kathy. And if you would like to fill one of those out and follow the steps on that, we would be glad to see that you get credit for that. This morning, I have asked Rick Rouse, who is a friend of our next presenter, Dr. Dwayne Larson, to do the introductions. Rick?
Thank you, Bob. It's been a privilege to be a part of this planning team, and we're just delighted that all of you are here to enjoy these days here at Holden. I have just an announcement before the introduction of our next speaker. Hopefully you've all read in the LENS newsletter and other publications about the upcoming Religion and Science Conference that will be held next Thursday at PLU. Dr. John Polkinghorne will be with us, and a colleague of his, formerly from South Africa and now a professor at Princeton Seminary, Benzel van Huysten, will be with us live via interactive video from Princeton Seminary. It's a two-way interactive video conference on the title, The Mind and Purpose Behind the Universe. Now, if you can't be with us at PLU next Thursday, you can join us on the internet. This is something new for us. And we're going to make this conference available for 2 weeks on the internet. And in the LENS material and other materials that have been mailed out to you, you'll notice that there's a website. It's www.cunet.edu/cosmology. And for 2 weeks, the lectures given at the Religion and Science Conference next Thursday will be available. The nice thing about the internet is you can, of course, plug in at any time of day over a period of 2 weeks to replay those lectures. We are already having some requests from a number of colleges across the country that are going to be gathering some students together and using this as a teaching tool and a time for conversation. You might think about that for some of your congregations. Again, a way of making theological education more accessible to the outlying areas of our region, and hopefully you'll check it out. If you have more, if you want more information or have questions about that, I'd be happy to visit with you later. It's now my distinct pleasure to introduce a distinguished graduate of Pacific Lutheran University. Dwayne Larson is a graduate, magna cum laude, 1975 from PLU. He holds an MDiv from Lutheran Northwestern and a PhD from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. One interesting connection is that Dr. John Polkinghorne was a reader for Dwayne's dissertation. So their connection goes back a ways. And Dwayne considers John a great mentor. Dwayne is currently the president and professor of systematic theology at Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque. Before coming to Wartburg about 2 years ago, he was a professor of systematic theology at Gettysburg, the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Dr. Larson has written many publications, and I have like about 4 pages if you're interested. But I'd like to just point out a couple of publications that he is especially interested in you knowing about. One is From Word and Sacrament, A Theology for Diaconal Ministry, published by Fortress Press. The Historical Dictionary of Lutheranism, published by Scarecrow Press. And Times of the Trinity, A Proposal for Theistic Cosmology, published by Peter Lang. Dr. Larson is active in numerous professional societies, including the American Academy of Religion. He's on the steering committee for the Theology and Science Group of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the European Society for the Study of Science and Theology, the Society of Anglican and Lutheran Theologians, and is currently the chair of the Lutheran Episcopal Coordinating Committee, charged by the ELCA and the Episcopal Church for carrying out the work of CCM. He is a John Templeton Foundation Award winner. We are greatly appreciative of your being with us and look forward to your message. Please help me welcome President Dwayne Larson.
Good morning. Thank you, Rick and Bob, and all of the gracious facilitators of this conference. Thank you for your hospitality already. I've so much enjoyed. I want to take this opportunity at the outset to give a couple of long-delayed words of thanks. The first, Rick already alluded to it, but I'd never had the opportunity personally, publicly, to thank John for his work in steering me in a very helpful direction as truly a mentor to me in my academic reflection. So thank you, John, so much for not only the dissertation help, but the comps. That was a big job for him, and I think he bit off more than he knew he'd get when I asked him to help out in that respect. And I also want to give a word of thanks to Holden Village. This place is dear to me, though I haven't been here for about 20 years. I've been here once before, as I said, about 20 years ago, for a month, early in my ministry, and that frankly was a time of great healing for me, and a setting of a right course, a getting recentered, and so I'm grateful to come back and in some small way to contribute back to the wonderful, enriching community and ethos of Holden, and whoever wants to receive that thanks personally on behalf of Holden, I'm glad to give it. So. Thanks to the Holden ethos for all it's done for me. My interest in these days is to come at the theology and science engagement in a bit different a way, and that is to try to do so as, at least purportedly, a confessional Lutheran theologian. I don't want to do that because I think Lutheranism is only just beginning to catch hold of what is possible here. about this incredible flowering in the last decade, decade and a half, of science and theology for its own kinds of lenses and conversation about God, universe, salvation, redemption, church, what it means to be a person, and so forth, with our usual Lutheran language. We often, it seems to me, resort very quickly back to our kind of Lutheran nomenclature, perhaps unreflectively, as perhaps even a defense mechanism for what can be a scary issue about science and theology. So I want to see in these lectures, and please help me out, it's a group endeavor, whether we might be able to unpack some things about our Lutheran identity by way of some of the confessional material, if we could go back and see that if even initially there were some intents, authorial intent, that's a strange word to phrase to use these days in postmodernity, but if we can recapture some authorial intent about the Lutheran confessions, that would be all the more illumined by what's going on with the sciences. In a way, as John said yesterday, his agenda is to note the striking features of the universe which ask for a larger explanation. So I want to kind of make it a bit converse. I want to explore science to see how theology could be appreciated as yet more expansive. So maybe we can even have a more expansive theology out of our conversation in these days, as has been the case with the last, as I say, decade and a half. And when I say I want to attempt to do that, I also want to begin with an appropriately humble Lutheran methodology by way of a joke that's favorite to me. Some of you perhaps have heard this, but it gets at what I think is the role of scientific language, but most certainly theological language, as penultimate at best in describing what's going on here. The joke has to do with three theologians. We'll make this an ecumenical joke, too. It can have all kinds of applications. One theologian is a feigned Reformed theologian. The other, we'll say, an Anglican theologian. And the third, a rigorously Orthodox, confessional, conservative Lutheran theologian. Not to put too fine a point on it. They find to their dismay that they die rather simultaneously. They're there at the proverbial pearly gates, and to their further dismay, they discover that they have to take an exam if they're going to stay. The first to be called in is the Reformed theologian. The Reformed theologian says, well, of course, this will be a piece of cake. We have this thing called the doctrine of predestination. In fact, double predestination. Clearly, I am predestined to be here. I should pass this exam, no problemo. Walks in. Only 5 minutes out, comes out, stalking away, thoroughly flustered. He said, Bart was right. The whole doctrine of predestination is thoroughly confused and in shambles. It's broken, no use. It didn't work. For whatever reason, I didn't pass the exam. I can't stay. I don't understand. And he stalked away in utter, utter frustration. The Anglican theologian was appropriately somber and was reading the Psalms, and even as a hedge, as he was shuffling humbly in, saying lauds. And 10 minutes later, the Anglican theologian came shuffling out in deep, deep grief, singing, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. I did not pass the exam and I cannot stay. And tears just streaming down his face and chest, he shuffled away in deep, deep grief. The conservative, orthodox, rigorously confessional Lutheran theologian had been watching all of this without a word, stern-faced, back straight, chin out, thorough aplomb. That theologian walks in. 20 minutes later, God walks out. I love that joke. It's about the only one I tell these days, but I think you get the point. Sometimes theologians get so particular, and you know, there's a role, of course, where that's appropriate, but so particular and so finessed, so precise, and so invested in the system that we forget the priority is about relation with the divine rather than right words. Sometimes we get so concerned about the right words that we replace, to use the Latin phrases, the fides qua with the fides qua. We replace faith as the trusting relationship with that content of assertions about faith. And then, of course, we get it all wrong. So whatever we do when we would speak as theologians, we must remember that God's in the room. And that it's not a matter of only speaking about God. We have to at least practice some Kierkegaardian awareness that all of our words can only go so far. And so perhaps finally when it's all added up, it's about a bit of indirection. It's about using the fides qua, the faith as believed, the content of the faith, even the assertions, so to serve the fides qua, the trusting relationship. It's about finding ourselves as we just were in that wonderful music experience in the context of doxa, in doxology, giving praise. And in that experience, then we find out, well, now what does that mean? We'll do a little post-experiential reflection. That's the fides qua piece. That's appropriate, so as to make sense of our experience and drive us ever back, as well as to drive the other back to doxa, back to the doing of doxology. Indeed, I think that was a brilliant mode that we found ourselves in last night under Susan's help. We found ourselves that a word about became a word within, so to connect so-called objectivity with subjectivity, to make that bridge and find that there's something more important going on to which the words drive us, but for which finally words are inadequate. So there's my Lutheran caveat, that as much now as I will likely speak about God, to recognize together that we are trying for so much more, almost in a Barthian way, to speak from God and in God, to God, with and for, and sometimes against each other. Right? Now, when I get at that, I want to do this in three ways. I want to continue here in a bit of an introduction. And then I want to talk about Luther's, what I'll call, sizing up of God. This is going to get into some historical reflection on the history of the doctrine of the Trinity. And so that's necessarily about language about things. From there, I will want to turn to contemporary Trinitarian theology as I get at this question of being in and with and from God for the cause of doxa, that the whole world might redound, that even the rocks and stones would sing glory. And in reciting that kind of a contemporary reflection on the ground of Trinity, upon which John commented or alluded yesterday about relationality, at that point I want to get into some of the things that new scientific perspectives might be able to unpack for us theologically. And then finally, just to suggest, sort of to drop them out there as catalysts, a few implications, ramifications for other places of our typically Lutheran thinking. And my apologies to those who aren't Lutheran among us, but just please bear with me and maybe you'll find a way in which you can appropriate that for yourself. Now, so I've stated the one piece, now to continue my introduction. There are many ways in which also I'm interested in this topic of doing it from a Lutheran perspective that we would confess that Lutheran theology has been kind of parochial. And in going back usually to our latter Lutheran statements in the back half of the Book of Concord as our usual reference, and going at that, we forget that the whole preamble to it all was about an original Catholic impulse, that is, an original unifying impulse in the role of the confessions. You nod your heads. I can see that you understand that. There's something really important that we will need to address, and I'll particularly look at that tomorrow, that happened in the latter half of, well, say, the second generation of Lutherans, just after Luther and Melanchthon's death, where you saw the division of Lutheranism into so-called Gnasio-Lutheran party and the Philippus Party. There was something metaphysical going on there in their worldviews that they saw as contradictory, that I will want to address, that has lent toward finally just a Lutheran parochialism that looks at the Lutheran language alone without addressing the metaphysical assumptions that those parties were debating by. And in fact, I kind of think, maybe this would be a fireside chat item, that we reap some of those unfortunate separations even today when we would have a conversation on ecumenical issues as well as science and theological issues. It's interesting to me, just for as a hint, that folks on the Philippus side of the equation in that second generation of Lutheranism also found themselves, for example, like Osiander, deeply interested in Copernicus and in the natural world. You don't see that on the Gnasio side. I wonder what that means. It'd be interesting to see someone write about that. So that's just a bit of a hint. Finally, and most importantly, this is what I'll get to in my third piece, is that the method question needs to come to the fore in a way that says that our Lutheran necessity of beginning with the theology of the cross as a methodology has too quickly meant the dismissal of natural theology. As if natural theology, for some reason, is always a theology of glory. I think that's a simplistic rendition of the theology of the cross. I will want to get at that a little bit today, but especially just before our departure on, Thursday. So those three things I'm interested about are just having as Lutherans not attended to the conversation. How can we expand our theology? Number two, how might we be a little less parochial and a bit more Catholic, that is, kat holos, according to the whole, to see that this science and theology conversation can lend toward the question of unity. And then finally, the methodological question, how can the theology of cross cohere with a healthy natural theology? So that's section one. I'm going to turn now to Luther's sizing up of God. Just kind of a quick Reader's Digest version or survey of Trinitarian theology from the 3rd century up to now. About 3 minutes. You know, John did it with the history of the world, so with history of the cosmos, if he can pull that off, you know, I think I've got a good shot at doing this far humbler task. To begin, Luther, as you know, was not a systematic theologian. Luther understood himself as an Augustinian, and therefore simply assumed, because it was not an issue of debate, no big existential crises surrounding these things, he assumed the priority and the normativity of the doctrine of the Trinity. But what was behind the assumption? What had been communicated to him in the history of theology? If we were to go back to Thomas's Summa Theologica, there is an important break between the normativity of the doctrine of the Trinity and how then theology was conducted with respect to creation. It goes like this, and you can read this sort of history, for example, in any number of good surveys, but the best for me was Catherine Mowry Lacuna's God for Us. The late Catherine did an exquisite job in bringing forward how the doctrine was metaphysically important to the Cappadocians back there in the 3rd and 4th century. Why was it that this was common talk when one went to the barber shop or to get a cut of meat? But after Thomas, something quite fateful had happened, and that was consequential for the rest of the theological tradition. Thomas's Summa, as you might know, begins with De Deo Uno. The first big section, section 1, is about the one God. All right? The next section is De Deo Trine, on the triune God. And here, Thomas basically repeats what is standard orthodoxy. But what is interesting is that when Thomas goes to the third section on creatio, on the doctrine of creation, one does not see the really nicely finessed reflection that was done in the second book on the Trinity exercise any influence on his natural theology. It is as if the normativity went back to on the one God. So one could speak of God, as it were, in generic terms, and one might speak in terms of what Moltmann came to speak of as a kind of a functional Unitarianism in a doctrine of creation. I mean, what was the gain in confessing the triune God and then doing all sorts of mental gymnastics to try to make sense of what it would mean to say three and one and one and three? This is the sort of mental gymnastics that finally with Augustine, although that was before Thomas, of course, finally with Augustine had meant for Augustine to throw up his hands and say, you know, finally for me it doesn't seem to be all that much different. And in fact, here in the real world, when we would speak about God's activity, we must be very careful, Augustine said, to ensure that every person shared in all the works of the divine. And so there's a famous Augustinian phrase, which I think actually came after Augustine. I have not been able to find it in any of his own primary work, that the external works of the Trinity are indivisible. That is, the opera Trinitatis ad extra indivisa sunt. Anything any person of the Trinity does is equally done, shared by all the other folks. But then, interestingly, Augustine said, and that the opera Trinitatis ad intra divisa sunt, the internal works of the Trinity are, in fact, identifiable, separable. Well, the problem is, everyone agreed you couldn't get to the internal Trinity and see what's going on inside the Godhead. So it was incredible speculation removed from evident concerns about the real world, about God's practical economy. What did this have to do with creation? What's it have to do with redemption and our ongoing attempt to be Christian with each other in the Godhead? So there was kind of a fateful collapse. Again, what Moltmann called that functional Unitarianism. But there are a couple of folks. I call them the minor or minority voices who exercised great influence, I think, later for what would be a recapturing of Trinitarian theology. These were Richard of St. Victor, who did prefer to think of the persons in a much more identifiable way, that each of the persons, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, had something unique going on with them that they would share with each other. And Richard of St. Victor in the 11th century came to speak of the Spirit as the bond of love between the first and the second persons. And that bond of love was so great, and the consequence, as it were, to use unfortunate, limited temporal terms, was so large, then it means that the Trinity embraced all the life of the world, of the creation indeed. Somewhat similarly, well before Richard of St. Victor, who's interesting to me, is Hilary of Poitiers. Hilary was a Western theologian. Why this is important, I'll come to in a minute, who, for whatever reasons, got outed or dismissed by his congregation. He was kind of a grumpy guy and was not politically astute, and so had to flee from the West to spend some time in the East. He spent his time in the East with what I like to call the Cappadocian brothers, Basil, Gregory of Nyssa, and Gregory of Nazianzus. They had a very interesting take on the Trinity. Their take was different from what came to be standard Eastern Orthodoxy. Standard Eastern Orthodoxy, when it came to talking about the Trinity, would give priority to the Father and say, basically, to oversummarize, that the Father distributed the works to the other persons, to the Son and Spirit. So you might think of Father here sort of at the top of a pyramid, and then a couple arrows of dispensation coming out to the Son here and the Spirit here to appropriate works. And the Father is the fountain and origin of the Godhead. That's how the Orthodox would put it. The Cappadocian brothers went a different way. They said that the Father gave to the Son and received from the Son, and the Father gives to the Spirit and receives from the Spirit. That's very important. It was a more of a reciprocal relationship, you see. rather than strictly dispensary, rather than strictly hierarchical. Hillary was very taken by that. Hillary took that back to the West when he could get back home and preach to his own crowd and teach to his own crowd, and began to assert the reciprocal relations of the persons of the Godhead. Though eventually Augustinianism came to overtake that and speak more something like that functional Unitarianism, everybody did everything, kind of a choir with one voice, you know, singing just one part. But Hilary was a different voice, and I find that interesting because Luther liked Hilary. Luther read Hilary. I think Luther unsystematically began to practice what Hilary was trying to say, even as Luther saw himself as the faithful Augustinian. So that's just an historical thesis. There's a lot more work that needs to be done to ground that. But if one were to look at Luther, and we could probably access this readily ourselves, one finds very quickly that Luther had no problem economically, as it were, of talking about the different separate and appropriate works of each of the persons of the Godhead. Just look at the structure of the catechisms, right? What is important for Luther in the structure of the catechisms, or however he thought about it in other ways, was that he began with the revelation of the Godhead in and through Jesus Christ. This is now where we move into what I call Luther's sizing up of God. Note in the large catechism that Luther says, after he's gone through pages and pages, all this God does out of pure love and goodness without our merit. God has done wonderful things for me, for us. He speaks more corporately in the large catechism, more individually in the small catechism, as you recall. God has done amazing things, relates to the whole creation, for us, on one hand, for me, on the other. But what he does there is allude to the second article. Luther, in fact, alludes to justification. God's creation work is linked to the doctrine of justification. I'll be more focused about that tomorrow. So Luther says, all this God does out of pure love and goodness without our merit. Sound familiar? What do you remember at the end of the second article of Luther's small catechism? How Jesus does all of this out of pure love and mercy, though I most certainly do not deserve it. Christ becomes now the focal point. We are told in the first article that our entree is through the second. The way we recognize the size of God is to look at the scandal of particularity, is to look at, in fact, how small, how humble God has become. That's where we begin. We enter Luther's understanding of life in the Trinity, as well as the epistemological priority of the theology of the cross by way of that second article. And so Luther says elsewhere, although God is everywhere in the created beings, and I would love to find him in stones, or in the fire, or in the water, where God indeed is, but God does not want me to look for God there. God is everywhere. But God does not want that you are looking for God everywhere, only where the Word is. Susan's help last night. There you must look for God, and there you will comprehend God. The ambiguity, as well as the ubiquity of God's presence, other than in Christ, is heightened when we recall Luther's language, of course, of revealed and hidden God. The wonderful works of God in nature may well, for Luther, bear more than instrumental or aesthetic significance. They are beautiful, to be sure, and they are the expressions of God's intention. But what we find out from Luther is that God wishes us to partner with God by means, particularly through the revelation of the Christ. And then we see, after we put on the lenses of the crucified Christ, how God is indeed so expressly deep in the creation everywhere else. God is present in love, to be sure, everywhere, Luther is saying. But we are to remember that not at the cost of the collapse of God's mystery into every visible and palpable trace of the love. God acts freely. Now, this is a very nuanced piece. Luther wants to start to get at a natural theology. But Luther doesn't want to give express permission to get at it from any entree. There is only one entree, Luther is trying to say. But then after that, you have a correct vision of what's going on in the universe. Just a quick sidebar. I think the point is made there epistemologically by the story of the Magi. If we simply remember Matthew's little homiletical point here in the preface to the birth narratives, that what is it, so to speak, that gets the Magi to going toward the Holy Land in the first place? Well, it's their very healthy understanding of the natural world. They get there at the initiative or catalyst of a natural theology. You know, the dancing star going ahead and so forth, right? But what happens? It doesn't get there quite far enough. It only gets them to about 5 miles from the right place. And they get 5 miles, can't get any further. And then, of course, there's irony upon irony because the people of the book don't understand the priority of the book and misread it. And they say, oh, yeah, it says right here this fellow's supposed to be born just 5 miles, you know, southeast of here. The Magi take that to heart. It's the doctrine of the Word operative here. And what happens? Now that the doctrine of the Word has taken priority again, natural theology is seen again in its appropriate role because the star is dancing again. They can see it rightly with the lens of Scripture. Nature and the book of nature and the book of Revelation are here interpreting each other. There is a priority on the Revelation side, but it is not separate from or over against the natural side. And that is, my friends, a thoroughly faithful Thomistic, Augustinian, and Lutheran observation. Now, Luther never, in other words, fought against the idea that happenings in the natural world may become a testimony of God in nature when and where it pleases God. An argumentative system of natural theology is one thing. Another thing is the sudden experiencing of God through the Holy Spirit in and through natural and social events. That is an ever-present possibility, beginning with the Theologia Crucis, with the theology of the cross. And from the revelation in the crucified Christ, the Christian expects that God wants God's self to be known down deep, even and especially in the most suffering interstices of the world. So the book of nature then is newly celebrated, wherein God, as Luther says, has described and painted God's self. So far, Luther's doctrine of the Trinity is only implicit. The epistemological necessity of beginning with the person of Christ is clear for him. The embeddedness of an understanding of world as creation within the work of Christ is clear as a priority for Luther. And so then, later, although I won't get into it, is our embeddedness in Christ through the work of the Spirit. All of that together implies Trinity, necessarily. But explicit comment by Luther on the Trinity is harder to find, as I've already noted. He has simply accepted the assumptions, though his practice went a more nuanced direction. There was no concern for him to engage in the abstract stuff about the inner being of God. But later in his career, particularly after his midlife, when he was more engaged with the so-called Schwärmer, you know, the enthusiasts who had swallowed the Holy Spirit, feathers and all, and also teaching against the sympathizers of modalism, that is, quasi-Arians of the day, there Luther began to preach more expressly on what he called the largeness of love that is God. Look at his sermons based on John and even some Pauline texts. Luther affirmed the Trinitarian reality in such a way that one could perceive the origins in Luther of something like a panentheism. God is so big that all is in God, though it is not all equated with God. Very important distinction. You likely know that's a big distinction. Pantheism is a big different thing from panentheism, all in God. And Luther was going that direction. God's presence in love, I'm thinking Richard St. Victor here, but especially Hilary, goes so deep, goes so wide, and goes so high, children's song there, became for him a challenge to the dominant metaphysics of the day. That's an important piece. Luther understood and attacked the dominant metaphysics of substance and of scholastic methodology from the nominalists and Thomists based on transfer or change of substance. He understood that and found that wrong. It didn't work. He worked more toward a relational language, which found that all was in God. And if all is already in God, as I like to say, kind of like a Russian nested egg set, if all is already in God, that makes a kind of a whole different perception operative here. One is driving toward different metaphysics of life in God, while one also wants to speak somewhat separately of God for us. God is other, yet us in God. Both hold true. As Susan was speaking last night, the Word as other, giving birth to Word in us, and so wording us. There's objective, there's subjective, but there is more than that. There's an overcoming of a dualism here. I'm not saying Luther is a postmodernist. I'm sure that there'd be many people enhanced by contemporary postmodernity who would want to say that, but it's very interesting how his early insight could drive that direction of overcoming subject-object split. Overcoming the difference wrought by substance language and seeing now that it's a matter of identities established in and through relations. Identity established in and through relations. So Luther finally wanted to say, if one wanted to paint a picture about love, one would have to paint a picture of the very being of God himself, and you could not put it, of course, in any dimensional, three-dimensional piece of paper. It would be an infinitely large picture. God is so large, and God is God, because God is also so small. It goes through all dimensions. Now I'm going to move on. I want to go more contemporary and talk about the Trinity as the ground of diversity and unity. Today, especially in the last 15 years, we've seen a wonderful reflowering of Trinitarian theology. Now it's starting to get all the more, within academic circles at least, into a very careful pneumatology. Lutherans have not attended, as well as most mainline theologians, have not attended to these topics for some while. It's interesting that on the Roman Catholic side, back around 1930, Karl Rahner initiated a whole new reflection on doctrine of Trinity. And likewise, on the Protestant side, did Karl Barth. And they came up with some quite similar conclusions. What unfortunately got in the way, of course, was World War II, on one hand, but then eventual fad went a bit astray about the language of death of God. It took a while, a generation or two, for us to catch back up to insights of Barth, and Rahner. But what is interesting in that recapturing now of reflowering of Trinitarian theology is the insight that it was important back there in the third and earlier centuries because it had something to do with reality. It had something to do with metaphysics. For Lutherans, getting back into the doctrine of the Trinity has been, after a long period of existentialism and a long period of modernity where theology is about moral concerns, established primarily by Albrecht Ritschl late in the 19th century, at that point they said, you can't do metaphysics, we're doing it again. Lutherans are a bit, bit more confident that we can talk about a Christian notion in at least large outlines of reality. We can state, in some respects, just what reality is about. At least under fairly large rubrics. substance language so much under concern there as relational language again. Going like this, that the Son is the Son because of the donum, that the gift of what the Son receives from the Father. The Son is the Father because of what the Son gives back to the Father, and it all works just that way with the Holy Spirit as well. A continual trialectical relationship that gets so complicated, it has energies, it has consequences well beyond those triune relationships. It's not just insular then, there's reverberation of what the persons give to each other. Think of the triangle, you know, the prototypical Augustinian insular triangle as a symbol of the Trinity. But now make those triangles geometrical rays. Okay, draw them out, draw arrows. You can put Son and Father and Spirit at each of the vertices, and then set the whole thing in motion because God is dynamic. And what do you get? You get consequence. You may get creation, as the Eastern Orthodoxy tradition has said. All because these persons are relating to each other, giving of themselves to each other from eternity for eternity. Today, we speak similarly under the influence of Moltmann and Pannenberg and Eberhard Jungel, Walter Kasper, a whole number of theologians, Catherine Mallory Lacunia, Elizabeth Johnson. We speak today similarly that the point is not substance, the point is relation. You know what it is the persons make up each other, God the Trinity. They could not be single, like, of course, some sort of three-handed bridge club, and thus be Trinity and give consequence as in a world. But they are ever, eternally, beyond our dimensional understandings, with and for and under and in each other. And they are not persons apart from that being communal. They are diverse precisely because they are together. Now, it might be a bit of a quick of a leap right now, but time means I have to do that. Imago Dei certainly means something about the beautiful rational character of the world and our ability to understand it. I believe in an Augustinian way that is not merely a resort, again, to traces of image of Trinity language. I believe that Imago Dei also is necessarily communitarian. One can go back to Genesis and recognize that what is created as a plural that is beautiful, and what is created as humankind and as a whole ecology is beautiful precisely because of its interrelationship. And of course it would be interrelated because that is how the Trinity is. After the image of God, the Trinity, so of course would that which is in God's image be interrelated. It would be a unity of diversity, not some kind of collapse unitarian humankind all looking alike, but all humankind and communal precisely because we are different. We make each other up. We give to each other. I'm going to stretch things, I'm sure, and invite argument by commenting on a couple of resonances, it seems to me, with respect to some of the sciences that John brought to us last night. I think of this entanglement phenomenon. I like to talk of it in other settings, like saying that the particle goes to the quantum singles bar and says, "Hi, you know, what's your spin?" You know, charmed, I'm sure. It links up. You know, it links up with the other one, right? But then in the quantum universe, it's kind of like human cultural life. We practice serial monogamy. It soon leaves that one that it linked up with there in that quantum singles place and links up with quantum particle C or D or E. And indeed, whatever happens with the one will have effect on the other one on the far side of the moon or at a different singles bar. But what's also interesting in that entanglement thing, is it not so, that whatever effects are made there in that primary binary relationship also have recurrences on every other relationship that particle has had. Every other relationship. There's no, how can I say this here? I think of vision and expectations and that... Particles have to practice safe relationships. Because you know that whatever you're getting everybody else too. Well, in a humorous way, that underscores that entanglement very quickly becomes a cosmic web, doesn't it? And people, a creation that is created after the image of God, the Trinity, is itself necessarily meant for a concordant web. No one is an island. We intuit that readily. And there's all kinds of intersubjectivity going on that in fact means an objectively constitutive difference. We make each other up. You would not be who you are, for better or probably for worse, were it not for me, and vice versa. Even before we met each other, we constitute each other. There's something going on here, kat holos, according to the whole, that is, Catholic, apart from which we would not be persons. Musically, we started this morning in a wonderful way. This is a favorite image of mine, to get at what it means, obviously in metaphorical, indirect way, for God to be Trinity, and so what it means for God to intend a certain kind of concordant world. And that image for me, where's Tom?
He left.
Okay, too bad. Oh, okay. That image for me is in choral music. When we were singing parts, and you start to get those parts really nicely tuned toward each other, the timbre is just right, not too much tremolo there, just the right kind of even handed pitch here and vocalization. When all the parts are really together, you've got great choral music, but you know you've really got choral music when there's a physical consequence called overtone. Right? You know that. When you experience overtone, the hairs on the back of your neck go up. And that's when you say, ah, choir happens. Perhaps in a metaphorical way, similarly, when the persons of the Trinity relate to each other from eternity, and thank goodness it's eternity, it's the embrace of all temporalities, not just temporality, not just one dimension, our temporality. When the persons of the Trinity relate to each other from eternity, God happens. And it's not a consequence. It's just always there because of what is given to and fro with each other. That's not a social model of Trinity. It's not a Unitarian model. It's something different. It's something, how shall I say, and I suspect John will talk about this afternoon, it's holistic. It's emergent. And what Luther saw, I want to propose, is that God's people are meant to be an emergent sign of what God intends for all the creation, beginning even in the most suffering place, where God went down the smallest, humblest, deepest at the cross, so to show that God is in the largest and is the largest of size, and that when we would be giving of ourselves to and each other in God, with God, for God, we are that sign, yet the church, as it were, as God's, another mode of God's ongoing creation work, of how the world is intended by God to be. Now, of course, I'm also broaching here the question of why is it not that way? Why is it that those towers were attacked and came tumbling down? I want to get to that. I really struggled with this, like many of you, I'm sure. I was thinking of abandoning my whole approach before I came because it just seemed so irrelevant when I was stuck in my grief and confusion about what went on in New York and in Washington. And so maybe I thought it would be more appropriate to try to start most explicitly with the question of theodicy. But no, to start there also probably is a Lutheran mistake. Because if we were to start rather with a holistic understanding of the way God has given it to us now, we understand hope is with us in the suffering. And we are given to each other as those signs of hope
not as individuals finally only, but certainly as that, but as a larger emergent phenomenon, which the world sorely needs. So I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'll stop there. I think Luther is driving toward that. And when one would look at Luther's sermons, as well as his earlier work, one sees that Luther's size of God is functionally different from standard Trinitarian thinking that he appropriated from Augustine. It gets more toward what has been happening currently with relational understanding of the Trinity, and so then, of course, an intended relationality in the universe. Thank you very much.
Same schedule as the community here at Holden. We still have a few minutes that we can ask some questions of Dr. Larson.
Dwayne.
And so we have two microphones. They're both on. If you would like to address a question to Dwayne, let's do it at this time.
My question is about, as you're talking about this movement of Luther in terms of his own understanding, the thing that moves with that about the kind of promise of the mystic thought is happening is also the mystical movement within the church,
yeah,
which was very Christianized.
Yeah. I guess I owe you some money or something, because that's a segue to tomorrow's lecture. There is, and has been again, a minority voice in Lutheranism in two ways. What I want to call a mystagogical strain that we are recapturing. One sees it in Osiander, who was mistakenly understood by the Gnasios who won the debate, particularly with the solid declaration in the formula of Concord. One sees it in later missionary theological types like Wilhelm Leia. But from second generation on, and also somewhat linked, of course, with the Pietist movement, but that was anti-rational, there is a strain that is both rationalist and mystagogical that we can recapture. And one of those places where we are mining that today in early so-called Lutheran orthodoxy is in the work of Johann Gerhardt. I'm going to talk about him tomorrow. So there is something there that we can catch. You're correct. You're really onto something there. And all the more, what's really important about that is that they believed the language of Christ in us. Whereas we have been so exacerbated in some of our intramural debate because there has been a language, call it forensic or whatever, I call it the Bette Midler from a distance Christology, where it's the pronouncement of the word of out there that makes all the difference, so that, and it's enacted upon us in kind of a heteronomous way, that would mean under the modernist consequence of ritual and others, it is made an internally no difference whatsoever, except that now we are called to give some kind of keener moral attention to it. That's a problem that has happened. I'm sure I'm not very clear right now. I'll try to make it much clearer tomorrow. There are a variety of things that have happened that have gutted our tradition of the appropriate, both mystagogical and objectively declarative creational discourse about God. They need to be fundamentally together from the get-go. And by the way, another allusion to tomorrow is that some of the work in contemporary theology that really helps us on this score, I believe, is being done by the so-called Finnish school. Okay? Manerma school and so forth. I'll I'll allude to that tomorrow. Sir.
Thank you for referring to Finland. I'm from Finland, and I was a student.
Yeah, good.
In ipso fide Christus adest, right? I have a question for you about, based on my readings of Luther, he despised reason to a great extent, and he loved the spirit, and I could not quite figure out what he always meant by that. Now, Melanchthon was a different kind of creature, as you referred to in your presentation. Has that, in your mind, led to kind of differentiation of rational theology, also natural theology, and Lutheran theology? And has that eventually, and this is my main thought, because my special field is philosophy, led to the Wittgensteinian kind of thinking, where you separate theology from philosophy and natural sciences and say that theology is a language game of its own, and you cannot play it by the rules of philosophy and natural science, and therefore you can't really talk about that. And I'm just wonderfully surprised that you're apparently starting to talk more about the them together.
Well, what a wonderful complex of questions. I'll try to be brief. I think, when Luther attacked reason, what's at issue there is the method of the theology of the cross having been not accessed. When Luther attacks reason, Luther attacks it when it serves a theology of glory, when it does not start with God having been so small and so counterintuitive to a scholastic frame. Otherwise, Luther is exceptionally, quintessentially reasonable. In fact, you can make the argument that reason informed by theology of the cross is more reasonable and thus necessary than all reason or generic reason. What's important there, I think this leads also to an understanding of two kingdoms thinking, is that the Christian is called then to see stereoscopically. Reason as commonly exercised, reason as illumined. Now this sounds terribly arrogant, but I think for a Lutheran Christian, one has to be serious about this. Reason as common that the Christian ought to understand, and illumined reason under the, you know, from the frame of the cross, behind which stands the God of the resurrection, that helps us to give a larger sense to common reason. A reason uprooted from the cross, that's what Luther called in the hard term of hoher reason. But then go on even, tomorrow I'll talk, or it's Thursday, I'll talk about the Heidelberg Disputation. You go on and then find out that Luther argues in an exquisitely wonderful scholastic way once the theology of the cross has been there as the foundation. All right? And so that's not, by the way, that is not at all then an attack on natural theology. It's an attack on a kind of natural theology. It's an attack on the kind of natural theology that John rightly said yesterday is dead. The mechanical one. The one whereby when it's all finally systematized, you can say, there, I've got the answer to it. And as Kierkegaard said of Hegel, the problem was Hegel forgot he hadn't died yet. So the system isn't really closed. There's more to come. Right? Now, the other part, I thought I was trying to be brief, that you allude to today about Wittgenstein and then language game, language analysis, and the contemporary, what I'll call the Yale School of Narrative Theology. I can share this. It was 1987. I was with George Lindbeck on a Berkeley street. And Kobe had just come out with this, you know, the Celestial Background Observatory. That big experiment there of this satellite had measured and had found the edge of the universe to be exactly where, in terms of the temperature of the edge of the universe, to be exactly where the Big Bang prediction had thought it would be. And so George Smoot and all sorts of other folks said, it was like seeing the mind of God. And San Francisco Examiner, and typically hyperventilating kind of headlines, you know, had this in 32 points. It's like seeing the mind of God. And I said to George, well, that's got to be an interesting piece for theology now. And he said, why should it? Because there is a school that does go out of Wittgenstein into today of narrative theology that is primarily catechetical. But I understand you learn the game from within, and that every discourse has its own thing, and that we would have to finally, in order to really understand each other, learn to bridge discourses, I suppose. But he really advocates jumping from one game into the other. Frankly, there are many places where I would access narrative theology to make a certain point, but I am not satisfied by it. I think you've got to make a metaphysical claim. And so I fall in with the so-called Chicago school on that side. If we're not going to pretend to talk about reality, then why try at all? I mean, why talk at all? There's something about the underside of postmodernity there which says anything goes because nothing counts that I really don't want to follow. I think Luther was interested in a metaphysical claim. Certainly we see that in sacramentology. Why would we want to sacrifice that later and say, well, it's just a language game? Now, I'm overstating the narrative theology, too. It's not just a language game. There's something done there in an indirect way, again, like Susan was doing last night, that is very real, that is also a recognition that it is not enough to talk about God as if God is not in the room. I'll stop there. Thanks. Sir.
Hi. You articulate beautifully. Thank you. I would like you to, there are a couple of things that you, couple of terms that you use that a lot seems to hinge on.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you mean by them.
Okay.
And,
not unusual.
Yeah.
That's about me. It's,
well, it's actually about the nature of what we're doing, isn't it? Because
Okay. So
much of what we're doing is like defining terms and trying to understand what... So natural theology is not a slam dunk. I mean, it's not absolutely clear what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Another word that you use that I've never even heard before is mystagogical.
Yeah.
Is that the word you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it might be helpful, at least it would be helpful to me if you could... In the future and now even,
maybe
unpack those things a little bit so I can track with them.
Okay. Mystagogical is that, I'll work from the back, from the back to the forward. Mystagogical is a metaphysical mode of mystical. Mystical is a predicate that does not necessarily have a It's in the language kind of it's an epistemological reference. Yeah, it's a good start. Yeah, mystical is a mode of knowing. Mystagogical is a mode of being. Okay, and so the language came up with Lutheran Orthodoxy. Just about the time of Johann Gerhard. So mystagogical has to do with some kind of implicit, again, metaphysical claim. There's a reality thing going on. We're mystical as we could be the adverb. Okay. The other part, theology of natural theology, let me distinguish that from a theology of nature. Natural theology, classically understood, is to suppose that you could work from the ground up in an inductive or deductive way. You look at the parts, look at all the systems as best as you can gather that, and then make large inferences about the character of the universe. And with respect to theology, then, on the basis of the parts, make inferences about the character of God, the whole. But as Luther said, that's not necessarily so easy or streamlined a line of argument. Now, a theology of nature is a different thing. And I suspect both John and I are speaking more in that arena than we are in strictly the classical mode of natural theology. But what the mode of theology of nature does enable us to do, again, this is Luther's point. Having met Christ on the cross, we can then go back to nature and do those inductive and deductive things. Or, and this is perhaps the more careful of all, we would recognize that there is not a direct line from nature to God, but there is exceptional resonance or consonance, finally, of what we would read in nature as we would then bespeak it theologically.
That was so good. I've got another question now.
All right.
Could you talk about the sort of classical distinction between dogmatics and apologetics as you're understanding it and as you're using it now?
Apologetics means to try to make the case to convince somebody else that one ought to believe either this system or that this system adverts to a real being of God. Okay, so apologetics is about the rhetoric of convincing. Okay, and that's a very useful thing to do. Theology can be put to that end. Dogmatics, strictly speaking, is simply the proposing of the various themes of a theological system and what they would mean and how they hold together. Dogmatics is internally oriented with respect to theology. Dogmatics is even in the language game approach of the Yale School, dogmatics is the re-articulation of the internal system of belief. And you might equate that to that content of the faith, the fides qua that I noted early on. Okay?
The other piece with mystagogical is also found within the sacramental theology that arose out of the first and second century of the Christian Church. And I guess the other side of that is that I think sometimes as Lutherans, the word becomes so dominant that sacramental theology, beyond the sacraments themselves, gets lost.
Yeah.
And just...
Thank you. That it? Thank you so much again. It's been very helpful for me.